Hi, good afternoon. I'm Barbara Postema, this is Marjorie Wilinska. We're here for More Than Words, The Appeal of Silent Comics. And we'll introduce ourselves, and then I've got a bit of a history overview of the silent comic form and some examples, and then we'll have a bit of a discussion and also questions from the floor, if there are any. So, do you want to introduce yourself first?
Sure. Hi, welcome, and thanks so much for coming out. My name is Marta Hulinska, so I am an artist and cartoonist. So I have made a few different wordless narratives. In 2009, I published a book called Back and Forth, a novel of 90 lino cuts. So the story was entirely told without words, all made through printmaking. And since then, I've done a few shorter stories. In 2012, I produced an anthology of different stories by different artists that were erotic wordless stories. So I have a story in that anthology called Wild Seed, which I think Barbara will show a few images of. And then 2 years ago, I also put out a sort of fantastical story that is also told without words called Morphus. And I guess most of my comics sort of look at sort of like female identity, relationships, a lot of like emotional things. So silent comics can be really good for that. And I also work as a librarian at the Okada University, so I have a bit of the librarian side in me as well.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Postema. I am a comic scholar. I've been teaching at Concordia University, currently teaching at Ryerson, and I've been working on a project about wordless comics for 3 or 4 years now, which is going to be a book eventually coming out with University of Toronto Press when I have time to write it. But in the meantime, I've been doing a lot of research on the history of wordless comics, on the various genres that kind of seem to be cropping up in wordless comics regularly. And so that's what I'll give a brief presentation on first, and then we'll discuss. So silent or wordless comics create their narratives without the reliance on text in word balloons or captions. The term silent comics and wordless comics neither of them fit completely comfortable. Silent comics do not display silent words. There's always the implication of sound, of dialogue going on. And they are sometimes called pantomime comics. They don't show their characters communicating in pantomime, in mime. So you see people talking, just don't have the word balloons with text in it. Instead, the represented worlds are to be taken as having sound as one of their physical features, including dialogue. However, the creators of wordless comics have chosen as a formal constraint not to include sound in their comics. In some ways, silent comics are similar to silent film, but the main difference is that while silent film did not include sound due to technical limitations, silent comics leave it out by choice, so that constraint. These comics are also called wordless comics, perhaps because comics, being a printed medium, are always silent. They never produce any physical sound. The term wordless comics pinpoints a key way in which this genre diverges from the traditions of the comics form. According to many definitions of comics, including R.C. Harvey and David Carrier, a central feature of the form is that it always combines word and image. Harvey calls this the visual-verbal blend, for example. Wordless comics lack one of these key ingredients. They may include word balloons, another key feature of comics, but these balloons will not contain verbal text. These are some of the aspects that fascinate me about wordless comic as a genre or as a form. They challenge to establish ideas about the form and the notion of a formal artistic constraint as a generative, as something that produces other different kinds of artistic ideas. As, for example, choosing to write a sonnet, adopting that kind of form, can be a productive choice as well. Finally, wordless comics provide a way of isolating the visual sound of comics, allowing focus on the many ways in which the image communicates in comics. So you can't fall back on reading the dialogue, reading the captions, and using that for most of your information. You have to get that information from the images. In silent comics, there's a long tradition of drawing attention to social ills and calling for change and resistance. That's something that's started in the 19th century, but that we see especially in comics in the 20th century, notably the 1910s and 1920s, and I'll show you some pictures of that in a bit. And one of the reasons that I think so many silent comics end up with messages about social adjustment, social engagement, is that they have to convey their messages without words, and so they don't fall back on the kind of sloganeering texts, a sloganeering language that that maybe puts off readers. Instead, wordless comics really engage their readers because readers have to fill in all this information, not even necessarily in words. They don't have to apply labels to things that they're reading, but they are called on to interpret and I guess, you know, almost translate the visual narrative that they're seeing into a narrative in their own head. So this notion of an active reader is something that I see at work quite a bit in wordless comics. So here's some examples of early wordless comics. This is from 1896, from the magazine Simplicissimus, which was a German satirical magazine. It contained editorials, stories, illustrations. Generally, most issues also had some kind of comic, and often these were wordless comics. So this is the entire comic. It's a one-page story, and as you see, it has this woman in a little attic room at the top of a building who has a sick child. All that information is gleaned from, you know, the ceiling is sloped, so it must be at the top of the building. There's medicine bottles and spoons there, so the child is sick, and she has to leave. She's wearing her hat and her coat, so she's going downstairs. Here, now she's picking up a companion for the evening, presumably making money to support her child. Here she comes home, tired, and now death has taken a seat next to her child. So this child that she left to go earn money for has passed away during her absence. And the title of this one page, which is the only text here, is Umsonst, for nothing. And I find this story, since it deals with single mother, it deals with prostitution, and yet none of those labels are put on there. And so that language that contains a message of judgment in some way is not put into effect in the same way, because you're looking at this as images, and the images tell the story of a mother, as well as, of course, the other activities. The main activity, perhaps, of what she's doing with this man is very very subtly elided. We don't see that going to the last tier, however far this companionship went. So this is a fairly early example of wordless comics, one page, and, of course, in a style that's not necessarily very cartoony or comic-y. It's very representational and impressionistic as well. These are two examples of woodcut novels. That's a tradition that was started really by Frans Mazereel, a Belgian woodcut artist who was anti-war, pro-labor, and again, that's material that comes out in his work in The Passion of a Man, The Passionate Journey. But again, he tells these stories without falling back of language of propaganda or anything like that. He's not saying unions, he's not saying workers, even though these messages come very clearly across in the stories that he tells through images. Mazereel was very, very influential and was eventually his example of making these woodcut novels, which are books that have one single panel per page. And so that's similar format to Marta's book that's circulating. And so sometimes there's discussion whether these are even comics because they only have that one single panel. Certainly Mazereel did not identify as a cartoonist, but they're very clearly examples of visual narrative or graphic narrative. Here's his The City. So he's got a fairly simplified style, not a huge amount of detail. And on the other hand, there's this incredible depth that you can see in the woodcuts that he has here. Landward is a wood engraver rather than a wood cut creator, and because of the particular technique, correct me if I'm wrong, by the way, because of the technique that he uses, I think he can bring in much more detail, so has much finer lines, I think in some ways much more idiosyncratic style to Masdale. So Lynn Ward is an American woodcut novelist. This is work from 1932, Wild Pilgrimage, and again we see the social messages. So the man standing there, he's the protagonist. First he feels alienated from society, he goes into the woods to distance himself from that, but eventually feels that he can't exist there by himself, and so he returns and joins these other people who are kind of struggling for their existence. Ward also made a number of children's narratives, so here from 1973, I think this is a lead cut, so it's a slightly different technique, or it might even be painted, I'm not entirely sure. Again, a narrative told only in pictures, told in full page panels, and this is the Silver Pony, so it's about a child who is basically worked too hard on the farm, escapes into his imagination, but eventually also has a kind of an accident because of the way that his family has been pushing him to support their work. So again, this is a children's story, but it also has a bit of a social message. Catching up much more to the present. So this is Eric Drucker, the book called Flood, very much inspired by woodcut traditions, as you can see in his kind of stark black and white style. The scene of the city there being flooded and burning at the same time is maybe even a little bit reminiscent of Masdale's the city. So he's using both very clearly a comics register in the way that he uses multiple panels, but is also using a style and a kind of message that's very familiar from woodcut works like Franz Masdale's. This is a little bit more of Eric Drucker, another book called Blood Song. And more woodcut work. This is from Britain, and more recent as well, 2010. Neil Bousfield tells this story, Walking Shadows, which is about, again, it deals with class and about people who are living through a grind of only living to work, dropping out of education and things like that. So the social conscious message very clearly there. This is Sarah Varen. She makes picture books as well as comics. And the few of her comics are wordless. This is from Sweater Weather, and here she often uses these animal characters, anthropomorphized animals, and in this case, this is a story of a raccoon here who's being evicted because his landlords, the rabbits, have an ever-expanding family, and they need the house for the new bunnies that are being born. And they're able to work out some kind of compromise so that they build this new addition on the house and everyone's happy again. So it's somewhat about housing problems, about being able to engage with your community in some ways, which you see here as well. This is one of her picture books as opposed to one of her more graphic novel or comic works, Chicken and Cat. Cat visits the city, not terribly happy about everything that he or she encounters there, and in the end, chicken and cat create a community garden, plant seeds and have a garden so that they can improve their neighborhood. Here is my final example in this historical overview, I'm Not a Plastic Bag, which is a comic about the waste islands in the Pacific, in the, what's it called, the Pacific Gyre, where these huge islands that are just made up out of trash, and here that island has been given some kind of agency, and it speaks only through these slogans that you can find on pre-printed badges and on grocery bags. It's odd because this island is, on the one hand, it's made up of trash, it's kind of abject, but it's shown in this comic as just wanting to be friends with the sea creatures that it sees, but that it also endangers, of course. Here, nice day, trying to attract this seagull. And in the end, the island kind of dissipates and blows away. It's a message that is very much about environmentalism, and the book comes with an excerpt at the end, or with an essay at the end, that in language speaks about these matters about the problem, about excess plastic, and that kind of thing. But first, it tells this story that that gets very emotional and that actually asks readers to have an empathetic reaction to this trash island. And again, it's something that I think wordless comics, speaking in images, it seems, do that very well, speaking on that emotional level without language necessarily getting in the way. So here are some examples of Marta's work. This is from Back and Forth. And so you see that she's making woodcut narrative here. And like I said, it's the one panel per page, right? This do. Setting is in Toronto, so a lot of the images in that book are very, well, it's actually between Vancouver and Toronto, but certainly in the Toronto section, it's very recognizable. The streetcars, the subway, the CN Tower, that kind of thing. These are two pages from Morphis, so still very few panels, although in this case there's two images per page, I think. And this is from Wild Seed, so we chose the same for family viewing images from that story. I don't think it gets too racy anyway. I don't think this is from a story, but I thought to have this as the background for the rest of the discussion might be apropos. So I get really excited about wordless comics, and there's a huge range of them, and there's, you know, new wordless comics being made every day, very short ones, long ones. There's been newspaper strips that are wordless, there's entire graphic novels that are wordless, there's a whole range. Marta has made some, so I thought maybe first we could explain, is there anything in particular that drew you to that form? Was it woodcut? Was it not having to write dialogue? You know, how does that come?
I think there was a lot of layers to that decision. Part of it was, so I made Back and Forth while I was studying at Bouquet University, the art school here in Toronto. So I was studying drawing and painting, and I was getting increasingly frustrated with the sort of options in the art market as a painter or creator of fine art in terms of what kind of communities are you reaching, what is the sphere of influence, not influence, but what is the sphere of people that you're accessing, and more I was realizing that it was a very small, limited sphere of very privileged people. So publishing was starting to appeal more and more to me as something that basically allowed me to speak to people who are on my level. So am I speaking into like a group of people who, like, am I creating art that I can't afford? Or am I creating art that a lot more people can afford and can be distributed more broadly? So part of it was that. I was also studying printmaking with George Walker, who's also made several wordless narratives. So I took a bookmaking course with him, and that's when I was introduced to the work of Franz Masriel, Lynn Ward, and other woodcut novelists. So Franz Masriel in particular was someone who spoke to me quite strongly. You can actually see some really great like first editions and original prints of his books here in the reference library in the art room. You can request to look at like little versions of his books printed in the beginning of the 20th century. And there was something really amazing about his work, just like the bold graphic quality of it. Like Barbara said, he was very passionate about social issues. I think he made like 50 wordless novels in his life, which for me is kind of hard to imagine. Like, he didn't have the internet to distract him, but he clearly had a lot of passion, and I think that passion came out in the woodblocks. So that was part of it, where I wanted to pursue that similar form of storytelling. Yeah, I guess that's what I'll say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're here for this Librarian Educator Day. Have you got, and maybe also from your own background as a librarian, what do you think about like taking away reading words, but adding, you know, reading other elements in these books? Do you feel that that is more activated by these kinds of texts?
Or? Yeah, definitely. I think one of the really interesting things about writing like stories without words is the way that it engages the reader. And I think for me, that's one of the most exciting aspects of this format of working. you know, like, there's so much passive taking in of culture in this day and age, whereas when you have a wordless story, you have to very much interpret it. You have to bring your own, you know, ideas as to what is happening. There are these skills that we're generating basically through living. We're observing the world around us and using that observation to understand what's going on. So yeah, definitely this idea that the reader is included in the making of the story is really exciting to me. I think that there's a time and a place for that. Certain stories it's really hard to do that with. So I don't exclusively work with wordless stories. There's other things that I want to specifically say, but I think that it's really nice to have that openness and let people bring their own stories into the work. There is some challenge to that, of course. Like, I am working on another wordless book, but it's been sort of put to the side, and I'm working on another project more predominantly. But I've been writing this other wordless, I've been writing a wordless novel for a couple of years now, and it's a much more complicated plot. There's a lot of different things going on in there, and I've just had to like face a lot of challenges in terms of trying to explain things without words, because with wordless comics, you're basically using people's assumptions as to what is happening, and that's how they're understanding it. Obviously, everybody's going to come with different assumptions based on who they are and their past, but there's these sort of like general assumptions that we can trust, like, okay, this kid is just doing this thing, most people are going to understand that this means this. But then when you want to introduce more complicated things, those assumptions can work against you. For example, I was trying to incorporate one of the characters in this new book was a trans person, and I was having a lot of difficulty with that, where it was like, how do I represent that without words and without, you know, like, essentializing this person to, like, their body or their sexual activity, which is, like, we don't need to have more representations of that in trans communities. So, yeah, just, like, the more, there's certain complex things that get really, really difficult to depict, and people's assumptions can start working against you. So, yeah, it's a bit all over the place, but, yeah, so you kind of have to be working with these assumptions, and sometimes you can use that to sort of lead people along to a certain place and then flip it and subvert it, but yeah, there's definitely limitations.
Yeah, so I think for me, in terms of reading wordless comics, there's the notion of multimodal reading that goes into it, all these different frames of reference that you have to draw on, as you were saying. So there's facial expressions, there's body language, very clearly, but then there's also this information that you get from the things that are shown in the background, just from distance, from movement, color scheme, light and dark contrast. All those things get involved in telling these stories. And as I think the three books that I'm circulating, one thing that maybe stands by there, if you look at the narratives of that, is that to a large extent they are very much about emotion. So Sarah Varen's Robot Dreams is about difficulty of making friendship, it's about loneliness, back and forth, it's about long-distance relationship and the difficulty of that, so loneliness plays into that as well. And then probably the most complex story in the books that have circulated is The Arrival, which is it's at the back there now, which is about immigration. It's about this man who goes, you know, ahead of his family to a strange new country to settle there and eventually to get his family over. And so this is a book that shows from his point of view, but also from a number of people that he encounters in his new adopted country, the kinds of factors that are pushing them out of their countries, the dangers that they're facing. And none of these things, again, are put into word. It's not called tyranny. It's not called, not tied to economics or something, but it's shown often in very visceral ways that shows that people can't stay where they originally grew up or where they started. And at the same time, it's a book that very much foregrounds communication. So it's wordless, but because it's wordless, it's foregrounding that this man is in a country where he can't read the script. It's a book that includes lettering, but it's imagination lettering. So no one can read this. And so the reader is put in that same position as this new immigrant of not being able to make sense. So this
hampers him finding a job, for example. He's using hand signs and little drawings to try and communicate with people to buy food that he needs. So it foregrounds communication, actually, by taking away the verbal communication. And I think, you know, does that in a way that that again allows a certain understanding about difficulty of entering into a new country, entering into a new culture, and to some extent putting the reader in that same place. So yeah, I mean, I have a whole list of wordless graphic novels that I'm happy to share with you if you have questions in that sense. Another thing that you often encounter in wordless comics that I think is sort of interesting is that there's a lot of room for ambiguity. So this notion of there's this one story and that's it, but you don't have that same sense of certainty often with wordless comics. I've taught, for example, The Arrival in classes about graphic novels, and different students come up with quite different interpretations. You know, not maybe in the main broad scope of the story, but in individual scenes, and they leave room for that. And so that, I think, is also something that's kind of nice, that you can have that ambivalence and not one set kind of demanded interpretation, because images work a little bit differently from text in that regard.
Yeah, I think that for me, when I was writing back and forth, I was writing about something that was very emotional and vulnerable, and not having to name specific names or put specific words to these like experiences was very liberating. And I think that those two things you described actually work together really well, because when you are helping to create the story, you become more invested in what is happening. You're like adding your own interpretation. So then when these like very emotional things are hitting you, it's hitting you deeper because you're part of the creation process. It's like, you know, like listening to a lecture versus doing a hands-on workshop. The more involved you are in it, the more deeper it's going to sink in. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. So for me, wordless comics are one way to get more of an understanding about comics in general, just because you have to pay attention to the picture so much. Again, because you can't just gloss the word balloons and move on. I'm always interested in those particular elements. What are the panels doing, the panel layout, the page layout, the contents of the panels. And it's a way to allow focus on that. So in some ways, maybe also almost a way of kind of teaching to learn comics. I think new comics readers are sometimes like, well, what am I supposed to read first? Where do I start? And with wordless comics, you're not torn between trying to look at the pictures or trying to look at the text. There's just the pictures to go on, and so that kind of trains you in a way.
Yeah, another thing that I was thinking of, just to the former thing in terms of like emotion and silence, is like thinking of the analogy of like film. Like if you're watching a film, just like a regular film with words, and then there'll be a scene where like it's just like a silent scene. Like usually those scenes are so powerful where you're just like, you know, it's just like somebody having a conversation in the distance and you're extrapolating what the conversation's about. And those kind of scenes like hit you a lot harder than necessarily if it was like you were listening in on the dialogue.
And I think that's actually something that you're seeing entering into the mainstream comics as well. Mainstream comics, like superhero comics, used to be very, very text heavy. Spider-Man is narrating everything that he does, and then there's captions, and he has this laid-back tone of describing people that he's following, whatever. There's a lot of text actually in those comics, and more recent mainstream comics tend to have, and it's especially in action sequences, which makes sense, but also other sequences, maybe that are more introspective, where there'll be stretches that just have no dialogue, and then they get back to speaking when that fits in. But so there are also works that are clearly not exclusively wordless, but just that use that as a tool for certain sections, just to be able to allow the emotions to speak for themselves. And there were a couple of 9/11 tribute comics which did that very deliberately as well, and they had titles. What were their titles? I think, there was one that was called A Moment of Silence. So this was, it was a tribute to, I think, mainly the firemen and the policemen involved in 9/11.
and it had that silence to it, but it also used silent storytelling to focus on those people and in some ways to let emotions kind of run free. So wordless comics, you encounter them more generally in alternative comics, in small presses or kind of independent work, but once in a while you do see it crop up in mainstream work as well.
Manga too actually uses that quite a bit. There's a lot more like kind of establishing atmosphere. So, like, you know, manga tends to be longer. You'll have like, whereas in maybe like more Western comic, you might have one establishing panel to set the scene. They'll have like kind of like multiple perspectives. Like, here's the sunlight, here's the grass, and it's just sort of like a slower introduction into what's about to happen. And that could be like a couple of pages, but it's still kind of takes you through the story without necessarily guiding you specifically or just kind of throwing you in there and there you are.
Yeah, so it's very much about pacing as well. Those are the main points that I want to make sure I shared with you. I don't know if you have anything to add right now, but otherwise we can take some questions.
McClellan referred to what you describe as user as content, where we teach comics, we invite our students to ensure that they don't effectively kind of give away the farm, that they leave room for their audience to become part of the narrative. And I just wanted to ask Marta, as a creator, where do you determine how much you want to surrender of that story to your audience?
It's interesting. Like, with back and forth, I've heard so many interpretations where I'm like, okay.
I didn't know I wrote that story.
Yeah. But, so I think for that one, It kind of depends, I guess, the intent of the story. The new work that I'm working on, I think there's a lot more importance in like definitive interpretations, which is where the challenge comes in. With back and forth, it was about like processing some things that I had gone through and presenting kind of an emotional landscape, presenting the way that women sometimes experience relationships. So for that, to me, there was a lot of room for other people. There was also some like ambitious time travel kind of stuff going on that I figured most people wouldn't get. So I don't know, I think that for certain, it depends, like it's the intent thing. Like the example that Barbara was showing with the floating garbage island, like that comic was followed by an essay because for that creator, there was like a very important social message. And it was like, if you're not getting it through this visual medium, I still want you to understand. And like Chester Brown has been doing that for his, like he writes books with words, but he's got like, you know, the past two books that he came out with, there is like this intense writing at the end to sort of explain and justify everything. But I like, that's actually something that I find very exciting about the medium. Like when I was in first year university, I read Roland Barthes' Death of the Author, and I was like, yeah, Death of the Author, Birth of the Reader, down with authors. And that was before I decided to be an author, no, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I just find that very exciting, like, you know, this idea of, like, stronghold over culture and how we are moving beyond that, and, you know, librarians have a stronghold over culture of, like, choosing what are the nice, morally proper books for their readers to read, and we're letting go of that, and I think in that we're sort of, you know, like, I think any opportunity to like admit that you're not right about something, I welcome that. Like I like making room for other people's interpretations, other people's stories, like cultural differences, stuff like that. Obviously I think cultural knowledge is very important in understanding a lot of these books. So in one way it's like a wordless book, you're not limited to a person speaking a particular language, but you are probably limited in terms of like a cultural understanding of certain images or tropes or something. But yeah, I think like the next book that I'm working on, it's much more ambitious. There's also some weird time stuff going on, so I have to be more specific and exact. But it really comes down to your like intent.
I also think it feeds back though, because you know people can read it, and as they're filling in, they're starting to effectively tell their story. Mm-hmm. And make them, you know, I mean, I grew up reading French comics, and I couldn't read French, mm-hmm. so I was really just reading the narrative and writing my own story.
Yeah.
And then when I finally read it, I was like, oh, my story.
Yeah. I think the really nice thing, too, is that with wordless stories, there's a lot of, like, opportunities for rereading. Mm-hmm. So you'll go through it, and then at the end you'll be like, whoa, that was happening, you'll revisit it again, and then you can reinterpret it with like the knowledge that you have from the end. So, and you know, like there'll be, because it's like, I think a lot of the time, at least when I read comics, I'm really bad, I'll just like vacuum them into my brain, I'll read them so fast, like, I just want to know what the story is. And that's really sad for creators, because it's like, I spent so many hours making those pages, and you just read the whole book in 20 minutes. So I think there is that tendency to start reading the book that way, so you might start reading it really quickly, but then in those further rereadings, you're going to read it more slowly. There might be all sorts of visual cues about the narrative that you'll pick up on later, so I think that's like a nice thing where it kind of builds on itself over time.
I think The Arrival is a book that demonstrates that pretty well in terms of, you know, leaving room for the reader. It's something that's aimed at a children's audience, but then a lot of the images are influenced. He's almost copying photographs of Ellis Island, for example, of the age of mass immigration. And child readers will probably not pick up on that, but it's the shape of the windows, the lines going through, it's very much there. And so he's not necessarily forcing that on them. Kids can read through and focus on other things, but when you then are rereading, or when you're reading it with someone else, that's information that can be filled in and fleshed out, and that maybe in some ways gives more of an ideological twist to the narrative, but so you can totally just gloss over that and read it just focusing on the family as well, for example. So, and one thing that he does is this pacing. There's these very big, almost establishing two-page spreads that allow just to pour over all the little details, and then he goes to a lot of small panels where the narrative ticks up much more. So you can see him kind of controlling things, but also leaving room for people to spend time and to fill in with background information as they want to, or have, you know, background knowledge that allows for that. Other questions?
I've seen, I've read somewhere that societies use, multilingual societies abuse comics as a tool for propaganda for communication. Did you touch on that a bit, or have you seen that in your own like Russia, for example, right after the Soviet Revolution?
Right. I don't know examples of that. My sense is that when comics are really used for propaganda, generally language is added just to make sure that there's no it's not misunderstood, that it's very clearly on message. But one example that I do know is Jack Chick, who makes the little Chick tracts. Generally they have language, but he has several that are wordless, purposefully to hand out in societies where there's very limited reading literacy, to get it, to still be able to spread the good word, I guess. But so yeah, he's deliberately using that. So yes, it's there as certainly there as a potential.
Are there any titles you can recommend that would give? I never took any art classes. I don't really understand the process behind it, but I'd like to learn more about it, and then I can pass that knowledge on about what is everything looked at in comics. Can you recommend any like standard books that can kind of talk about the artist process and how to
Make comics?
How to understand the techniques that are used, like different techniques, and just kind of basically understand what the artist process is a little bit more.
Yeah. Will Eisner has written a book about that called Comics and Visual Narrative? Mm-hmm. Comics and Graphic Narrative, maybe. But so Will Eisner has written a book, and it's meant really to train artists, I think, to some extent. But he also talks a lot about how he sees the form working. McLeod has Understanding Comics, which also, on the one hand, he talks about very much from a creative point of view, but he's also thinking about how the form works. In some ways, maybe he has such a strong sense of, like, this is how you read comics, that it's almost like he's closing off certain possibilities, but it's a useful text nonetheless. Yes, and he has Making Comics as well, and then Matt Madden and Jessica Abel also, they have actually a book that's basically a course pack. Like, if you want to make comics, here's a thing that you can do every week, and it has
It has activities to do whether you're working in a class or by yourself.
Pardon? I missed the name for that.
Oh, that's drawing words and writing pictures. And they have a follow-up for more advanced, very technical, particular skills as well.
They also have a website. I think for a while they were doing some sort of thing where people could, like, they were, like, I think it was like a forum or something where people were submitting, like, story developed ideas and they were giving feedback. So I think you can, I don't think that's active right now, but you could go to the archives and kind of see some of the recommendations there. Yeah. Yeah, I think Scott McCloud is like a big one. That one you should be able to find quite broadly. And making comics by Scott McCloud is pretty good. It's very, like, much more like technical planning.
Oh, comics and sequential art. That's the Will Eisner one.
Great. Thank you. If you're in Toronto, there's also an organization called Story Planet. So they do workshops. They used to have like their own workshop space, but now they go into, like, they exclusively work with schools now, so they go into classrooms. And they typically have these story maker workshops where they have facilitators that help students create like a character and create a story. And just recently they started doing comics maker workshops. So it's like a week-long thing where there's artists who come in and help students like create a character. And here's some prompts, like, what is this character's strengths? What are their weaknesses? What do they want? Like, what happens next in the story? So they kind of, I think it's like a week-long thing. So there may be arts organizations that are also doing that kind of work.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.